I'm Chris Mandel, director of the Sedgwick Institute. Welcome to this installment of Sedgwick Institute Live, where I profile influential thought leaders who make a difference and whose interests lie in the risk and insurance world. Today, I'm talking to Dennis Harwick, former president of the Captive Insurance Company Association, the leading organization supporting captives of all domiciles. Welcome to Sedgwick Institute Live, Dennis.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate being here.
And we appreciate you taking the time. So, Dennis, I always like to start these conversations with the personal so my audience can better know who the subjects are I'm talking to. So tell me a little bit about yourself, your family, and how you how you spend your free time.
Well, Chris, I'm one of these, as I say, a recovering lawyer who started my career as a general counsel for a bank and then in the mid-80s moved into the association world. I have a peculiar career path in that I was the CEO of three different state bar associations along the way, Kansas, Idaho, and Washington State. But in about 1985, when I began my career at the Idaho Bar, I'm a native Idahoan, I was about 3 weeks into my job when all of a sudden my phone started ringing one day, and it was when the professional liability market crashed. Turns out about 70% of the lawyers in Idaho had the same renewal date of October 1st, and the typical phone call went something like, I just got canceled by my insurance company. What are you going to do about it? Which came as a big surprise to a freshly minted association executive. But what actually happened was a bunch of small states got together, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Kansas, New Hampshire. And within about a year's time, we formed an insurance company to do nothing but professional liability for lawyers from smaller states. I didn't know for 20 years that that was a captive insurance company. It was simply a response to something. And after I spent 20-plus years in the Bar Association world, I got over the wall and was looking around about the time that CICA, the Captive Insurance Companies Association, was creating a full-time position as president of the association. And as part of my due diligence, I actually called my old friend from ALPS, the Attorneys Liability Protection Society out of Missoula, Montana, who this was the company we'd formed 20 years earlier, and asked him, I said, is this a captive insurance company? And he said, yes, didn't you know that? And so at any rate, the circle came around, and somehow or other, I ended up as the president of CICA and have been representing captive insurance companies and the industry for the past 13 years.
So that professional liability crisis was, what, back in the mid-80s, I guess?
Yes, yeah. This was in 1985,
And you formed the company in Idaho, is that right?
It actually, the company was based out of Missoula, Montana. It's still there today, a thriving insurance company. It's now an admitted carrier in most states and writes in almost all states, is my understanding. But it started life as a captive, even as a risk retention group at one time for lawyers in small states.
So even back then, Montana had a captive or a risk retention group law?
Actually, it's domiciled in Vermont. So at that point, no, Montana did not have such a law, and Vermont had entered that space. And so ALPS has been domiciled in Vermont during this whole time.
Oh, I see. Interesting. Wow, that's an auspicious beginning, but you're an unusual person for the background that you had and kind of the role that you assumed. You started in CICA in about 2005, right?
That's correct, yeah, right at the beginning of 2005. And I literally started in late January, which is only about 5 weeks before CICA's conference, and I hadn't even met the entire board of directors yet when I had to go run this conference. And during the walkthrough at the hotel before the conference started, I remember asking the administrative staff person, they had this big stage with the projection screens and the logo, and I said, well, who's up there? And he said, well, you are. And so I had to fake it the first year, and I may have been faking it the last 13 years. So.
Interesting. So before we leave CICA, give me some overview of CICA. When was it started? What's its mission, and And even though you just stepped down, what are its current priorities?
Sure. CICA is the original trade association for the captive insurance industry. It's actually the original trade association. It's celebrating its 45th year this year. It was founded in about 1972, and the origin myth is that a bunch of corporate risk managers were golfing and realized they were talking about captive insurance companies, and decided to form an association. So over those 45 years, CICA sort of evolved from being primarily a once-a-year conference to, particularly during, I guess, this past 12, 13 years, becoming much more of a spokesman for the captive industry. If I have tried to accomplish one thing during my tenure, it was to form partnerships throughout the industry so that all the domicile associations and related groups, such as the National Risk Retention Association, and the domicile associations both onshore and offshore, like Bermuda, Cayman, Vermont, D.C., Hawaii, and as you may know, about 38 states in the U.S. now have the enabling legislation for captives. So that we have formed these partnerships and be able to build coalitions as necessary if specific legislative or judicial issues have arisen. So CICA, like most associations, sort of has three primary duties, education, networking, and advocacy. And hopefully we've done a pretty good job at fulfilling all those roles.
How many members does it have right now?
Well, CICA has sort of a peculiar membership structure. We are technically individual members, and so and then we may have secondary members, but we will have individual members, but they may be from the large captive managers and from the various service providers. So we have 500 and some members, but that may represent thousands and thousands of captive insurance companies.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. I didn't know that the organization was the original trade group. I knew it was had been around for a while, but I guess I'd never had any intersection with you guys until I spoke this past annual conference. But you were talking about domiciles, and you're right. There's approaching 40 domiciles in the U.S. and I don't know what, almost an equal number internationally, or something close to it. So what about that? Do you think there's too many domiciles for the purposes of serving the captive insurance needs of entities?
Well, I think that there is, not to be too maudlin about it, but it's sort of a rising tide floats all ships. If there's been one recurring challenge to the captive industry, it's been that, many insurance regulators perceived it as some kind of strange, unusual alternative group. And just the fact that now 38 or close to 40 states have that legislation is changing that perspective, that they are a recognized risk management tool, part of the arsenal that institutions, companies, organizations can use to manage their risk. I think that's a good thing. Now, I do think that there will be as there is in most things, competition for people who are seeking captives as part of their economic development package, will find that they have to really devote the resources to be a good domicile. I probably get dozens of phone calls a year from someone who's thinking about forming a captive, and they always ask me, well, which domicile should I pick? And I always give the same advice, which is, you want a domicile with a good, experienced regulator. And I know this is sort of counterintuitive, that why would you want to go someplace that has a strong regulator? But the reality is, you want a regulator who knows what a captive insurance company is and doesn't think it's just a small commercial insurance company.
Right.
It's very important that they understand captives. That also usually translates into the fact that they will understand and be able to listen to the specific needs of that captive. One of the sayings we use often in the captive industry is that when you've seen one captive, you've seen one captive.
Mm-hmm.
They almost by definition don't fit into a one-size-fits-all template. And having a good experienced regulators helps you make the case of whatever special needs your captive has.
Mm-hmm. Is that the distinction you're making between, you know, just another commercial insurance company, that they're very customized and uniquely designed to the needs of the owners?
That has always been the legacy of captives. They, as I mentioned with my own experience, they almost always came about to fill what was a need that wasn't being filled by the commercial insurance market. If you go back to sort of the founding of the modern captive industry, a fellow named Fred Rice out of Ohio was trying to do the risk management for a steel company in Ohio, and was trying to do something other than first dollar coverage, and no one would allow him to do it. All state insurance regulators wanted were this template they had for commercial insurance companies, and so he looked around, eventually found that Bermuda would allow him to create these more distinctive, individualized companies, and that was sort of the beginning of the captive insurance industry in Bermuda. Many in the U.S. were sort of Johnny-come-latelys, and even though Colorado had the first state law allowing captives, it really was Vermont that figured out that, hey, here was an industry that was non-polluting, non-extraction, created jobs, and those jobs tended to be white-collar jobs and could produce a much economic development. And so, as you know, Vermont sort of got a head start on most other domiciles in the U.S., and until recently accounted for well over 50% of all the captives in the U.S. were licensed and domiciled in Vermont.
I always thought it was ironic that Vermont had assumed that kind of lead role, because, you know, I ran captives up there over my career, and I always groused about how difficult it was to get there, you know, but but it does a great job.
Yeah, the Burlington Airport is, you know, is a nice little airport, but it is a little airport, and so, but it really was a stroke of genius, if you ask me, that they recognized the opportunity to specialize, and have really provided a leading role. Though I need to quickly point out, there are another of other what I call legacy domiciles, both onshore and offshore. Obviously, Bermuda, Cayman, Luxembourg all come to mind as offshore domiciles with a long history. But within the U.S., Hawaii, D.C., South Carolina have all come along and been very strong, and many other states have really devoted resources to it as well.
Yeah, well, the reason I asked the question about are there too many is because I happen to sit on the board of the Captive Insurance Group in New Jersey at Sheila Small's request, and, you know, they're still at 23 facilities, even, what, 3 years after I joined, so that they're not really growing. It may have been the reason John decided to move on to Missouri, but, you know, Arizona struggled as well. I ran a captive there for USAA for a number of years, and I'm not so sure that domicile has grown much either since I left there 7 years ago.
Yeah, often, you know, there is a cycle of, does a state have the political will to really be a domicile? And I'll use Arizona as an example of a state that, when there was the economic downturn, they started making cuts, and one of the things they cut was the captive insurance regulators in the state. And so, essentially, the captive industry hit the doldrums there, and there's some indication they're now, you know, trying to revive that. But it takes a willingness of a state to really devote the resources to have good captive regulation. I have been preaching this for a long time now, and you see, you know, those states that are sort of the legacy states have decided to do that. And as they say, governors come and go, insurance commissioners come and go, but your captive regulators better be there for a long time.
Yeah. So while I know you're not from the risk management community as I am, or as you said, you don't consider yourself really from the insurance industry per se, having primarily a legal background, how important do you think captives are in the bigger picture of organizational risk financing?
Oh, I think they are a key component. And, you know, the thing about captives is I have to laugh over my career. I don't know how many times I've tried to explain this strange term captive, which at least again the origin myth is that steel company had captive coal mines that they owned so that they had a steady supply of coal, and when they formed an insurance company that they owned, they called it a captive like their coal mines. It has nothing to do with hostage insurance, but it it provides, the other thing, I sort of moving a little different direction here, but we have been in a soft insurance market for years now. And mm-hmm. the traditional wisdom was, oh, captives are a creature of the hard market. You're only going to be creating captives when commercial insurance rates get very high or coverage becomes unavailable. Well, that simply hasn't been the case for mm-hmm. a number of years now. People create captives for strategic reasons. The other analogy I give when I'm speaking to people not familiar with the industry is I say, you have to understand, you don't buy regular commercial insurance, you rent it. You rent mm-hmm. it for 6 months or a year, and then you have to renegotiate that lease. You don't know how many rooms it's going to have, what it's going to cost. And instead of renting your insurance, you buy the house. Mm-hmm. And it has all the headaches of home ownership, but it also has all the benefits of home ownership. You own the equity in the house. You have the ability to paint it any color you want. You have the ability to remodel it. And I don't want to torture this analogy, but captives are now really more a strategic move by risk managers, whether it's a single parent or groups, that allows them to address emerging needs. Cyber security is obviously one that's getting a lot of discussion now, employee benefits. And so it has that flexibility to have, and like I say, sort of your arsenal of risk management tools. And there's no doubt in my mind that they are here to stay and they're going to be a key part of the risk management industry for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great segue to something I wanted your opinion on. In the last couple of years in particular, I noticed the industry is talking a lot about, quote, ERM captives, unquote. What's your perspective on that label?
Yeah, well, ironically, SICA has considered this, and we really don't like that label. We think all captives are ERM in some way or other. And I know that this has been used as a way to describe the small captives, typically organized under the Internal Revenue Code 831B provisions. Frankly, they used to be called micro-captives, and the SICA board specifically adopted the term small captives a year or so ago because they didn't want it to be diminished like the word micro. But we think, we have not really liked the term ERM, and, it's just simply a way of describing these smaller captives, typically using the 831B provisions. But we have not adopted that terminology.
Yeah, I found it kind of interesting and somewhat confusing myself, being a consultant to the ERM space for a number of years now, and I didn't realize until you just said it that it's pretty strongly affiliated with the 831B classification, because what I hear more people talking about is just, let's just throw new stuff into these facilities and we'll call it an ERM captive, whether or not it lends itself to actuarial predictability or forecasting or not, which of course is problematic from a number of vantage points, but interesting opinion. So, we were talking earlier about regulators a little bit. What do you think the key couple of regulatory issues are today or going forward? I mean, I know that the prior administration under Obama was getting pretty aggressive about some of the tax issues surrounding captives. I don't know that that's going to continue, but where do you think the regulatory landscape is these days?
Well, I think one issue that is going to get a lot of discussion, and that has to do with the new administration's, or probably more technically, the Speaker of the House's tax reform package that is talking about a border adjustment tax. This will get a lot of discussion, and it's sort of the the equivalent of the value-added tax found in many other jurisdictions. But there is concern that somehow their financial transactions, and specifically insurance and reinsurance, will get swept up in this border adjustment tax. Almost all jurisdictions that have this kind of tax, whether it's a value-added tax or border adjustment tax, have excluded financial transactions, including insurance and reinsurance, because those transactions mm-hmm. go both ways,
mm-hmm.
and they wash out, and they don't lend themselves to that, you know, where you manufactured a process and, or excuse me, a product, and you sold it abroad and all that. And so, I think we are prepared, and we're working with other groups like the ABIR, the Association of Bermuda Insurers and Reinsurers, to make the argument that insurance and reinsurance should not be included in any proposed border adjustment tax. This would obviously mm-hmm. have a huge impact on the insurance industry if somehow that you were taxing those transactions every time you're ceding something to an offshore reinsurer. It's just not the way those markets work. So we see that as a major issue looming on the horizon. We did mention sort of the 831B, the small captive segment of the industry, has been under specific attack, particularly by the IRS, over the past year or so. The irony is Congress actually passed a bill referred to as the PATH Act that increased the amount of premium that could be deducted for the small captives, but it put some restrictors on there for areas where there were perceived to be abuses, particularly in the estate planning arena. But the IRS has went ahead and issued what is known as Notice 2016-66, which has imposed all kinds of reporting requirements, all of which is very peculiar because there's a major case pending on this small captive, what is allowed and what's not allowed, that should clarify it all. But it's a turbulent area, and there will be some shakeout in that arena as well.
In the first issue, you mentioned the BAT tax. I mean, are you guys perceiving that it's their intent to remove insurance as an exclusion from that? Is that what you are concerned about?
That's what we hope. There frankly just has been no discussion, no clarification in any of the proposals so far. But it's recognizing that there will be great pressure to raise money if they're going to cut taxes elsewhere, and that this is something that, you know, if you don't understand how these financial transactions work, could get swept up politically into that discussion, and we want to make sure that we're not caught off guard if that happens.
Yeah, makes sense. So another topic that interests me personally is this idea of governance. So, and I may have mentioned this to you in San Diego at the annual meeting, but it seemed to me, not just for captives, but for all organizations, that board member or having an independent board member is a pretty important aspect of best practice governance. That's not seemingly what the captive industry has recognized as important. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it has not traditionally, as you suggest, been a big part of the captive industry, because these companies were coming out of sort of internally within, whether it's, you know, corporations, single-parent captives. But there has been more and more of a move by the regulators, particularly for large captives, to suggest or require that there be independent directors. I think that will be a growing component of captives. I was involved with the International Center for Captive Insurance Education at a board governance course, and we had quite a thorough discussion about independent directors and how this should be part of the good governance role model for captives as they mature as an industry.
Mm-hmm. So would you say SECA would support that as a best practice?
We have several best practices documents. I don't think that is specifically, one of the check the boxes at this point. Again, We get back to that. If you've seen one captive, you've seen one captive. But I do think there's going to be a growing class of captives where that would clearly be a best practices under the good governance operations of a captive.
Do you know of any domiciles currently that require it, independent directors of any sort?
I know on a case-by-case basis there have been regulators who have asked that captives have an outside director. I say that just it's strictly anecdotal, but I know of a handful of people who are serving in this capacity, and I know that they are both onshore and offshore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very interesting. So, you know, Sedgwick is in the risk services, claim management, productivity management business. And I'm wondering, how do you see the claim professional's role in achieving the outcomes and results that well-run captives look for?
Well, this is probably where I'll jump back to my lawyerly disclaimer that not really a specialist in this industry, but clearly, you know, claims management, excuse me, is a key component of any well-run insurance operation. And, you know, captives, of course, have that threshold decision of whether they're going to do that in-house or they're going to outsource it to a third-party administrator. We had that discussion at our recent conference when we were talking about disruptive events, and claims management was one of the arenas where that clearly is going to be occurring.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Dennis, I appreciate your time today. Is there any other topic or issue you want to comment on for our listeners before we close this out?
Well, I guess I would just like to leave it as sort of my valedictory opportunity as I'm retiring almost effectively this month. But, you know, anyone who has any interest in the insurance industry really ought to take a look at captives. They are a vibrant, resourceful, innovative part of the industry. I've made so many good friends and colleagues, and we jokingly say we're small enough we still have the no jerks rule, where you know, no jerks allowed. Everyone knows everyone, and it's a very collegial and sharing group. And I guess my last word would be, you know, keep an eye out, make a career there.
Well, speaking of that, are you going to stay connected to the industry?
I think, ironically, hopefully once there's been sort of a decent interval and I sort of step aside for maybe 6 months or so, I would actually entertain and have been received a couple of inquiries about serving as an independent director on a board. And I laugh and say, well, that's probably because I know so many regulators and I've been running boards for 35 years. So that would be how I perceive myself, maybe keeping a finger in the industry.
Mm, very good. Well, I hope you do, because you certainly and obviously have a wealth of knowledge about it, having been involved for as long as you have. So, Dennis, I appreciate your time and insights today. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you, Chris, for all you do.
You bet. So to my listeners, you can find my and Dr. Richard Victor's, as well as Bill Zachary's speaking and writing schedules and our writings as well on our other resources at SedgwickInstitute.com. Please consider joining the Institute's LinkedIn group titled Sedgwick Institute, where we dialogue daily on issues of importance to stakeholders in the risk and insurance world. Till next time. When we'll have another installment of this with another thought leader in the business, I urge you to use your expertise and influence to make a difference whenever and wherever you can to make this industry better.